This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision making from two Canadians. We're hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore, portfolio managers at PWL Capital.
Welcome to episode 228. And this week, finally, we welcome the Chief Investment Officer of Avantis Investors, Eduardo Repetto.
Yep. This was a great conversation. We covered a lot of ground on fundamentals of asset pricing and factor investing and premiums and who should tilt toward premiums. Should anyone be a pure small cap value investor? And then what does that investor look like? Lots of interesting comments from Eduardo there. And then, of course, we also talked about the approach that Avantis takes and how that may be different from some of their competitors. Lots of interesting points on that as well. Lots of good analogies.
Oh my gosh.
We had a gas station sushi analogy.
Yeah.
There were a couple of other funny analogies in there. There were two food analogies. I don't remember what the other one was. Do you remember what the other one was?
I do not, but they were both pretty funny. I mean, it was kind of cool because we've known Eduardo a long time. So it was a pretty friendly, casual conversation, which was great. Tremendous experience in the field. He's brilliant, obviously brilliant, but a very good communicator as well.
Yeah. So for anyone who doesn't know, Eduardo is responsible for directing the research, design, and implementation of Avantis investment strategies, providing oversight of the investment team and the firm's marketing initiatives and interacting with the clients. So he's doing a lot, and that comes through in this conversation because he's clearly got deep technical expertise, but also a very impressive ability to communicate that expertise in a way that I think is pretty easy to understand.
I mean, we both know him a long time, but we know him from his previous role when he was co-CEO and co-chief investment officer and director at Dimensional Fund Advisors in 2017. So I've known Eduardo, as have you, for probably 10, 12 years at least, I would think, going back.
Yeah. His pedigree in this world of factor investing is about as good as it gets, as impressive as it gets. He's got his PhD in aeronautics from the California Institute of Technology. And we talked a little bit about the similarities between that field of study and his PhD dissertation, which he won an award for, similarities between that and financial economics. And to my surprise, they're a lot more similar than you might think. People think of physics as being a hard science and economics as not so much. And I think Eduardo challenged that.
Yeah, he pushed back on you. Yep.
Yep.
That's great. Anyways, here's our conversation with Avantis Investors, Eduardo Repetto.
Eduardo Repetto, welcome to the Rational Reminder Podcast.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Cameron. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we're super excited to be talking to you. Eduardo, most investors are familiar with a market cap weighted passive strategy, like just buying index funds. How do you articulate the difference that Avantis products represent?
Look, that's a fair question because we have been hearing, you know, market cap weighted portfolios like S&P 500, Russell 1000, Russell 3000, and, you know, the MSCI product for a long time. But think from evaluation framework. If you want to enhance expected returns, you need to consider more than price. A market cap weighted portfolio basically only consider price. If you want to enhance expected returns, you have to consider price compared with some fundamental data that is going to give you some information about what securities are being priced in the market at a higher discount rate. So if you want to do that, you need to use just more than price. And market cap weighted portfolios are not using anything but price. So that's basically the distinction. You want higher expected returns, you need fundamental data. And once you consider that fundamental data together with price, then you have an idea what securities have higher and lower expected returns. And then you can decide how to use that information to create portfolios that are expected to deliver higher returns to clients. And those portfolios will be different than market cap weighted portfolios because they are deviating the market cap weights, deviating from market cap weights to overweight securities that have higher expected returns, underweight securities that have lower expected returns. And you can do that to different degrees. You can do that having a portfolio that has similar risk characteristics to a market portfolio and S&P 500 by overweighting securities expecting to deliver more and underweighting securities that deliver less. Or you can do that by just focus on those securities that have very, very high expected returns and have portfolios that are more focused on delivering better performance. So look, Market cap weighted portfolio is a great portfolio. It's basically self-rebalancing. You don't have to rebalance it, but also has some drawbacks that you can, you're not really enhancing expected returns. You're just delivering what the price has in it without considering anything but the price.
Can you talk about the advantages of using the ETF structure in managing these portfolios?
Yeah, look, this is a great question. And a lot of people are speaking about direct indexing, SMAs, and all of us know mutual funds. And now we also have ETFs. So you can deliver the same strategy in different wrappers, in different vehicles. So imagine that you're delivering the strategy in a mutual fund. Well, how does it work? Well, if you have a mutual fund, when you are buying the mutual fund, you send cash into the mutual fund, the portfolio managers buy securities. And so everyone pays for that transaction that comes into the mutual fund. And when there is a redemption, the portfolio manager has to sell securities, but also has to carry cash. Because if you make a redemption, I need to wire the money as a portfolio manager. I need to wire the money basically right here, right now. But if I sell securities, they don't settle for a couple of days. So I need to carry cash to be able to satisfy the redemption. Or I have to hit the line of credit in order to satisfy the redemption and then sell securities to cover that loan or just replenish my cash buffer. On top of that, when I sell securities, I realize capital gains. And then the remainder shareholders, not the redeeming shareholders, the long-term shareholders get a 1099 at the end of the year with the capital gains bill. Yeah. So that's a mutual fund. If you think about an SMA, SMA basically is like a mutual fund. The difference that SMA, the separate account, is that you are not affected by the actions of other shareholders. If you are in a mutual fund and you're a long-term shareholder, people coming in and out impose costs of you and impose taxes on you. In an SMA, you are the owner. So if you come in and out, it's your own decision. So only your actions are affecting your portfolio. What's the problem with an SMA? Well, the problem with an SMA is whenever you have to rebalance, you have to sell a security to buy another, you are realizing capital gains, and this is a taxation event. Now, in the ETF, most of the rebalancing happens in kind. So when you have an ETF, people don't send cash. People buy the ETF in the market. A market maker, it's the one that sells the ETF to you, has to create ETF shares. And how does it do? In order to create ETF shares, they send securities to the ETF. So we, the ETF manager, receive securities. We don't receive cash. And so the long-term shareholders don't get the cost of buying those securities because we receive the securities in kind. And when there is a redemption, so you sell your ETF in the market, it's the same. The market maker wants to get rid of that ETF share. In order to get rid, we deliver to them, not cash, we deliver to them securities in kind, and they sell the securities and get their cash. So all the trading that happen inside the mutual fund and all the trading that happen inside the SMA, when you are in an ETF, happens outside. And since it happened outside, long-term shareholder doesn't get affected for all this cost, and also that is, since you're not selling securities, you're not realizing capital gains. So the ETF structure is a very, very efficient structure from the point of view of costs and taxes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Are there downsides to the ETF structure relative to SMAs and mutual funds?
Relative to mutual funds, probably there is no. But if you think about 401ks in the United States, 401ks cannot deal with ETFs. Why? Because a lot of the 401k operations happen overnight and ETF trade during the day. So all the system for 401k, all the plumbing for 401ks is basically set up for mutual funds or CITs, that is collective investment trusts, another thing similar to mutual funds. Relative to SMAs, if you want to harvest a lot of losses and use them somewhere else in your wealth management, an SMA can do that for you because there is no corporate structure like it's an ETF. ETF cannot distribute losses. An SMA can distribute losses because it's part of your overall wealth. Now, the drawback with the SMA is, I love the harvesting losses. And yeah, with all of that love, I can harvest loss here to use there. Who doesn't love that? The problem with SMA is that over time, you're buying equities because you think that equities will go up in price. So if you buy today equities and you have this cost basis, and over time, we expect them to go up, the basis remains low and the market value goes up. So any rebalancing becomes very tax costly over time.
Right.
That's all we an ETF. So it's for some special cases, an SMA certainly makes sense. Imagine that you sold your business today for $50 million, let's say. It's January. So you have a big capital gains that you have to pay by December. So if you put those $50 million in an SMA, you can harvest some losses to offset the gains. But it has to be this year so that you harvest those losses, because if it goes to next year, it's too late. In the United States, you cannot use losses from next year against the gains. And you see, I think Canada is different. So for some special situations, SMA probably makes sense. In most cases, ETF is quite good.
That was a great overview of the different structures.
We have some write-up in our website. If anyone wants it, just send us an email.
Awesome. We talked earlier about differences in expected returns between different types of stocks. How do you think investors should quantitatively assess the expected return advantage of a factor-tilted portfolio?
This is a great question, and it's a very, very valid question. So I will answer it in two ways. The first one is, do we think that there is an advantage? And then they say, if we think that there is an advantage, can we quantify that advantage? Mm. So the first part of the question, do we think that there is an advantage? And we really think that there is an advantage if you do it right. Why? Because not every security in the market is priced with the same discount rate. No, there is nothing to tell you every security in the market will be priced exactly the same discount rate. The moment that you have difference in discount rates across securities, that means that you're going to have a difference in expected returns across exactly. securities. And that's good. And now we know, okay, there is some logic why using fundamentals together with prices will allow you to identify securities that are expected to return higher performance to you in the future. So does it exist, the reason why some securities will perform better than others, and tilting a portfolio, we want to call it tilting, will do better than non-tilted? Yes, there is a reason. We believe there is a reason, and logic and data shows that there is a reason. Now, the second part of the question is, well, how much is the value added? You know, if I tilt this much, what should I expect my outperformance to be? And that's a way more difficult question, because the fact that we know that there is a reason why there should be an expected performance advantage doesn't tell you how much that expected performance advantage is. There is nothing that tells us that. And so then you have to record historical data. And historical data, no matter how you do it, is one path in history. And the premiums in the past can be higher or smaller than what will be in the future. And there is not much about that. But historical data is basically the only thing that is going to tell you how big is the premium that you are expected to get from the tilting. Now, you can do it in different ways. You can use historical data in a simulation, and you have a strategy, you simulate, and it's giving you an idea what will be the premium relative to the market or the benchmark that you're looking at. Or you can do it with factor exposure. So you do a regression analysis. You say, this regression analysis telling me that I have these loadings, the expected premium of these factors is so much, and then I'm going to have, if I multiply the loading by the expected premium, it's going to give me the expected outperformance that they should get by tilting. You have to be careful when you do factors, because the factor definition matters. The loadings are not amazing things that are constant and state variable. The loadings basically depends on how you define the factor. You can define a factor a little bit different than another factor, and with a different reconstitution than another factor, and then you're going to have a different loading. So factors are a very good way to do it. Simulations are a very good way to do it. Probably you want a little bit of both. Factors is probably faster. Anyone can do it. You know, you have websites that do the regressions for you on any product in the United States. So that's faster and easier, but you should know the caveats.
I have a practical question for you, Eduardo. How do you think individual investors should assess whether a factor tilt actually makes sense for them in their portfolio?
Oh, that's a big question. So now you're speaking factors in general. So the first thing that you have to say is, do we believe in this factor? Let's put it at that. And I don't like to speak about factors. I believe more about premiums. So, and we probably speak about that later. But if you think about factors, hey, there are more than 400 factors that have been documented out there. Do we believe it? All of them add performance? No, some of them is just noise. Some of them are real. They're related to some underlying linked to valuations or discount rate. Some of them are hedging. They provide a hedge, but they really don't provide any higher expected returns. So, for example, if you think about the small cap, everyone speaks about the small cap factor. So you say, I'm going to tilt towards the small caps. the underlying concept there is saying, hey, small caps are expected to deliver higher returns than large caps. And immediately you say, that by itself is a little bit difficult to think in isolation, because you say, hey, I have a small cap company and I don't look at anything but just the market capitalization being small. Do we think that that's all what you need to say higher returns? And the answer is no, because I can give you a small cap company with very high price related to fundamentals. You say, certainly that is not going to have higher expected returns.
Right.
So again, you have to have something that tells you relation to valuations or relation to discount rate, because the discount rate, the high discount rate at the end of the day is the premium. So if you want to assess if factor tilts make sense for you, first thing, be sure that the whatever you're thinking, whatever premium you are going after makes sense. There is something that it will persist. Once you know that it will persist and you think, you know, this is a real premium. Now I know that that premium is real. Now we can decide, is this premium right for you? And I think that for most people, there are very reasons, a lot of reasons why to deviate from the market portfolio. Under some assumption, the market portfolio is the most efficient portfolio. But those are very extreme assumptions. In reality, the more realistic assumptions will tell you that it's probably not the most efficient portfolio. There are many good reasons to deviate from the market portfolio and pursue some of this premium to some degree. Now, if you are an investor that is completely obsessed with tracking error because you don't trust your managers, you don't trust anything, so you have to index. You have to buy the S&P 500 index or the Russell 3000 index or some index. But if you are an investor that is more relaxed, that is willing to consider tracking error, willing to know that there won't be deviation from the market, then you can use these factors that make sense, these premiums that make sense, and really enhance performance of your portfolio with a better implementation and a better investment logic. And so, yeah, I think people should do it as long as they're not obsessed with tracking error.
So if tilting toward premiums makes sense for a lot of investors or most investors, who's on the other side of that trade?
Now you are going to one magnificent question. And the question, we can put it differently. It's, let's think about the market portfolio. And you guys are advisors and you have been in front of a humongous amount of clients. And you know that not everyone comes to you with the best portfolio ever. I'm sure that you have people that have the most weird portfolios that come to you. And probably one day you should do it. And it's just a whole session about that. And you have people that deviate from the market portfolio by weird portfolios, like single stock portfolios. And why they buy a single stock portfolio? Because they love the idea of having a single stock portfolio, or because they don't know the drawbacks of having a single stock portfolio. Or some people that deviate for good reasons from a good portfolio. They deviate from good reasons maybe because they owe a lot in taxes and they don't want to pay this tax because they can't or for some other reason, or they have restricted stocks. So we know a lot of people that deviate from a broadly diversified portfolio that makes sense for good reasons, for tastes and preferences. And so there is a lot of deviations from a good portfolio. They have people that have bad portfolios. If we know that people have bad portfolios, yeah, what is the market? The market is the sum of the people that have bad portfolios plus the people that have the complement of that bad portfolio. Okay. Why people will buy a complement portfolio? Well, they will buy a complement portfolio because the price incentive. Because it's more optimal portfolio than the bad portfolio. The market is the average of both, the more optimal portfolio and the bad portfolio that some people have. So why do we have portfolio that have premiums? We have portfolio that have premiums because there are differences in expected returns. They're different in pricing. And some of them is because people just price security, love some securities, some portfolios that are suboptimal. And if people have portfolios that are suboptimal, it means that there is some other portfolio that is optimal that will have a better risk return trade-off. And the market is just the average of both. So when we're tilting, when we're trying to find security with higher expected returns, what we're trying to do is getting toward that optimal portfolio. That is a portfolio that is broadly diversified, similar risk characteristics probably in the market portfolio by higher returns. So here at Advantage, what we do is we deliver those components that allow you to move towards that optimal portfolio. Make sense?
It does, but I have a follow-up question. So from the description there, it sounded like the lower expected return portfolios are suboptimal because people are making errors as opposed to hedging other risks outside of their portfolio. Like
it can be hedging. Okay. So when I said irrational things, so I told you, okay. Very bad decisions. Some people have very bad decisions. Hey, I like my 5-stock portfolio. You heard that in TV, yeah? But some other people have rational reasons why to do it. Taxes is one of them. Restricted stocks is some of them. Hedging needs is another them. Look, you work in the airline industry. Maybe you don't want to have airlines in your portfolio.
Okay, yeah.
There is a lot of things. When I say taste, preference, rational decision, it's a lot of things in one bucket, really. And it's suboptimal in some cases because of bad decision. In some cases, it's optimal for them. But they are deviating. The moment that they're deviating, there are some securities that are not buying. The moment that they are securities that are not buying, someone else needs to buy. But why will I deviate and buy these other securities if there is no price incentive? So probably there is a price incentive.
Hmm.
You mentioned something, Eduardo, that I thought was interesting. You linked the desire to avoid tracking error to trust. And you mentioned trust in the manager. Is it also fair to say it's trust in the premium? Because anytime you're different than the market, you're making that decision actively. Can you talk more about that trust?
Yeah, look, I think Myron, I heard this from Myron, Myron Schultz, and great guy, a lot of knowledge, and said, look, there is a cost for you to monitor your managers. And the cost of you monitoring the manager is basically zero if your manager is tracking an index. Because the only thing that you have to look is the performance match the performance of the index. There is really no cost of monitoring your manager. It's very, very simple. And so if your manager is deviating from the performance of an index, now you need to know more. You need to understand why they are deviating from the performance of the index. That's understanding the premiums, the logic, the strategy, and whatnot. And then you have to say the implementation is following the expectations that you have because of the deviations through the premiums or whatnot in the strategy, embedded in the strategy. So if you're tracking an index, it's very simple to monitor. The moment that you deviate, you have to understand the strategy and you have to understand that the strategy is being managed in the way that you expect it. So it's a little bit more difficult. And so some investors don't want to do that. They want zero tracking error. They don't have to monitor anything. And that's fine. There is an opportunity cost for that because indexing certainly is suboptimal. But, everyone is free to decide what they want.
I want to keep going on that idea of trust. And then you mentioned or alluded to a couple of times that there are hundreds of premiums out there, 400 premiums in one paper that you mentioned. How do you know that Avantis is targeting the right premiums?
That's super important for anyone, should be super important. It's certainly super important for us. And why? Think about this. Because you observe something in the past, you cannot think that that's a premium that will persist in the future. Remember payphones? Every big city in the United States and in the world have payphones. So we can make an empirical observation based on past data that payphones are a feature in every big city. Huh? It's empirical. We saw it since, I don't know when, payphones were in existence. Well, that's part of the past. It's not going to continue in the future. You barely see payphones in anywhere now. So in the airports, maybe, but not really. To the point that I want to buy one to put that in my house as a piece of art. I love that. the 9X payphones were beautiful in New York. It was, 4 years ago, but not now. So you cannot rely only on empirical data. And that's fundamental. You have to think about why this will persist. And for us, that goes back to valuations. You have to be something linked to valuation because what we really look is there a discount rate embedded in that price that is attractive? And that's the only thing that you can do is look in valuation. Look historical research on asset pricing models, factor investing if you want, the Colorado asset pricing models, is trying to find variables that tells us something about discount rates. That's a good research, by the way. The other ones is just looking for patterns. So for us, everything starts with valuation. Do I have a reason, if I look at the company, why this premium should exist? And if you think about that, is how you buy a company. When you go and buy a company, what you think about? Well, you think about when you're deciding how much to pay for a company, you have to decide, well, how much equity is in the company? Assets minus liability. That should be something that matters when you're pricing a company. What else matters? Expected cash flows. No, if the company is making money, it's different than the company is losing money. So expected cash flows matter. And then you're going to apply some discount rate to those cash flows because those cash flows are in the future, are expected, and you're not going to pay a dollar today for a dollar in the future. That's expected, not even certain. And so the price of a company will have to do the equity plus something about the expected cash flows divided by some discount rate. So that's give you a valuation framework where you can relate price, the equity of the company, and the expected cash flows of the company with the discount rate. And so why is that important? Because the market is telling us the price. And so the price is embedding a discount rate. And by using fundamentals and price, you can differentiate what companies have high and lower discount rate. So this is telling you evaluation framework why there is a difference in expected returns among companies and why some companies are more attractive than others. So once you have that valuation framework, you can say, okay, these variables, if I combine in one way or another, give me characteristics or ratios that are related to the discount rate embedded in that price. And I can use these variables together, not in isolation. You can use these variables, equity, cash flows, price, you can use together in order to differentiate what companies are priced with a higher embedded discount rate in the price and with a lower embedded discount rate in the price. And once you have that, you can create portfolios expected to outperform. So this is basically the way we think about creating portfolios instead of just chasing empirical data from the past that may or may not happen in the future. Now, the theoretical model in isolation is not enough because I can create a theoretical model that I move my arms and I should fly. I don't want to try because it's not going to happen. So you need a theoretical model that guides you on what to look, but also you need empirical data that corroborates what you're finding theoretically also work in practice. And you want to have that data, you know, across markets, across market cycles, because you want to be sure that works. If you think about my PhD thesis, was more or less about that. My PhD thesis was about creating a model that fits some physical phenomena and then trying to solve that model to see the finding from that model match the physical phenomena. Here's the same. You have a valuation framework that tells you what variables matter, and then you want to see that empirical data based on that model corroborates historical data and the premiums that you predict really were seen in the past, and that gives you a lot of assurances that should continue in the future.
Interesting. I'm curious, what type of investor, if anyone, does 100% small cap value portfolio make sense for?
You answer that one, or one of you answer that to a journalist in Canada, because a journalist in Canada told me, if you go to an island for 50 years, one of you answer, I take one portfolio. I know which one you say. I think the one is small value. A strategy. I don't know who of you, but look, let's go back to Markowitz, no? And I think that there is an interview that has a beautiful phrase. I will paraphrase. I wouldn't say his right words. I'm saying, look, when he was thinking about the mean variance optimization, he was saying, hey, it cannot be that people pick when people create portfolio, it cannot be that people pick the highest expected return security, because if you're trying to pick the highest expected return security, you're maximizing returns, just returns, but risk is not part of the equation. So you have to consider returns and risk together. That's what the guy Markowitz to create the means variance optimization, or the risk return trade-off, if you want to think about that. And so in general, I would think that most investors will be happy to have a small value, but as part of the portfolio, overweighted probably because they want to enhance expected returns. But having it in isolation will be someone very special. So someone that only buys small value will be someone very special, like you guys, if you go to an island for, I don't know, for how long you mentioned. And so who will be that someone very special? It probably will be someone that has excess capital, so money that they don't need really, a lot of excess capital, that have very long investment horizon with very long-term asset growth objectives. For someone like that, probably make sense. But most of us humans that are not in that situation, we probably have a portfolio that is a little bit more diversified than just a small value.
Good answer.
Such an interesting one, because small value might be more volatile. But when you look at, again, empirical data, like what outcome is more reliable, small value actually starts to look pretty good. So it's a tricky one to think about.
Remember, diversification matters. And that's, you know, we learned that from Markowitz, and Markowitz learned it by observing how people behave and then put it in a mathematical model that is risk return trade-off. But certainly there may be some investor that's the right portfolio, but most people will have something that is more diversified than just small market.
But it goes back to your comment about trust. You really have to trust in this premium.
Right.
Yeah.
To hang on that long.
You feel better if you think that that's related to valuation. It's not a pattern. And so that's why when you look at company holistically, instead of just picking a factor, like, for example, if you pick a low price to book security, no? A low price to book security can be a security that has low price because they really have no earnings. For example, and you say have low price because of no earnings. It's not because they have a high discount rate. The price is low because no earnings. I call them like gas station sushi. The price is low, man. We want cheap sushi. Let's go to the gas station. Well, I don't know if that's the right thing. I prefer to go to a sushi place like the one they have across the street. You guys should visit. It's an old Japanese guy, 10 seats. They have great prices, to be fair, and the quality is amazing. So, well, I prefer companies that the discount rate is high. The price is low, not because the company doesn't have earnings, not because the company is full of liabilities. I prefer a company the price is low because the price is embedded in the big discount rate. And because that discount rate is my expected return. Low price for the sake of low price doesn't tell you much.
Okay, so I want to keep going there. We're kind of talking about you can maybe trust the premium more when you combine relative price and something like profitability, which as we know, and many of our listeners know, are two of the metrics that you guys are looking at when you build portfolios. Can you talk about how Avantis targets value and profitability together?
So first, I'm going to take exception with value. You say first relative price, and then you call relative price value. And so let's define what's value. Value is not value in low price. It may be low price to book, for example, low price. But that's not value. What is value for me? For me, value is high discount rates. Now, when you go to buy something to the store and it's on discount, you know, big sale today. Oh, that's a value buy. If because the price is heavily discounted, that's value. So that's value for me. It's not just low price. And so how you come to have low price? You come to have low price because for no profits or big liabilities, so you can have low price because big discount rate. We care about big discount rates. So the only way that you have to find what company have high discount rates embedded in the price is to consider the equity position, assets minus liabilities, and the expected profits of the company. So you cannot do that with one without the other. Both of them have to be together. Because if you just only look at low price to book, that's what we spoke a minute ago, you can finish with a company that has low price to book because it has net operating losses. And that's not big discount rate. That's just low price. That's just gas station sushi. You get what you pay for. So what you care is I consider about these two things together, because these two things together go into evaluation of a company. When you buy a company, evaluation of a company will consider the equity position, expected cash flows that the company generating. These two things together go into the price together with the discount rate. So you want to use price and these two things together, the equity and cash flows, in order to assess what companies are heavily discounted. And once you find what companies are heavily discounted, then you know that you have a value portfolio, a good value portfolio, a portfolio that is high expected returns, not just low price. I think about low price to book or adjusted book, or low price to book profitability, as imagine that you want to have a good pizza. Yeah? Is good cheese enough? No, you need good crust. Is good crust enough? No, you need good cheese. You need these two things together for good pizza. So if you want to find a company that at this price is attractive, you need to look not only at the book value, you need to look at only at the profitability. You need to look at these two things together. There is no way out. And that's why we do that.
Is it done looking at those two metrics together? Is it done the same way in large caps as it is in small caps?
Yes. If it was a pattern, what we are looking, let's suppose that you are looking for a pattern. If you are looking at the pattern, you will think that the pattern in a small cap or the pattern in emerging markets or the pattern in large cap is different, and you will have to adjust patterns. But remember, we're not looking at patterns. We're trying to link everything to valuations. And valuations is the same. You're buying a private company, you're buying a small cap, you're buying a large cap. if you're buying anything that is an opportunity to make money, you know, we go back to the Babylonians and we were buying a business that sell donkeys, or we go to Mars in the future and we're having a business that sell water, it's about valuations. And so, yes, it's not the same because it's about valuation, not patterns.
Okay. So we talked about the two metrics that you use together and why that's important. Can we get into the nitty gritty details of how you actually weight those metrics when you're building portfolios?
Yeah. So basically we use a joint metric approach. So we consider an adjusted book to price and we assume a cash profitability metric. And we use them basically, if you want to consider equally. And why not weight one more than the other? So I cannot tell you that one should have a little bit more weight than the other. If you look at historical data, what you see from historical data, that the patterns are quite symmetric in the two metrics when you're using together. It's difficult to speak without numbers. I'm not going to show numbers here, but they're quite symmetric. So it's not that you consider them jointly equally. You may have to consider one a little bit heavier than the other. But there is not enough information to make one a little bit here and there and by how much. And so you have to consider both. We consider them equally. I cannot tell you that it should be 55-45 or 60-40 versus 50-50. I can tell you that it's quite close to 50-50. So that's what we use.
Interesting. Okay. Are there any downsides or disadvantages to using that joint metric?
I don't think so. You're using a more complete model than using anyone in isolation. And again, when you're buying a company, you will consider all these variables. So when you're thinking about the portfolio, you also should consider them together because that's basically what links to evaluation of the company. That links to how things work in, you know, in real life out there. And so I don't see any downside really. I do think that in the future, things can be even more complete. So models get complete over time, you know, more and more complete. They're never perfect, by the way. Models get more and more, they go better and better, you know, more and more complete over time. And so there's certainly opportunities to make it better, but the state of the art is here. And whenever the state of the art changes, we have shown that we are willing to embrace a change if it makes sense and is robust and whatnot, then we will do it.
Okay, I want to dig into some more nitty gritty details for a second here. So we've seen some research suggesting that cash profitability, which adjusts for accruals, is suboptimal compared to using operating profitability, which does not adjust for accruals, and directly addressing high investment firms, which some research suggests accruals are just a proxy for.
You're saying cash profitability versus operating profitability plus investments together. Yeah?
Yep. That's much cleaner. How do you describe why you use the cash-based?
I think I know the research. I know the researchers. They're great people. I'm thinking they're a friend of mine and whatnot. So, but you can look at the tables that they have and you will come to the conclusion yourself that there is no question, even they're recognizing when you look at the tables, cash profitability is a better metric than operating profitability. And right. You can link that to Robert Novi Marks. So Robert did an amazing breakthrough in my mind, one of the greatest breakthroughs that we have seen in many years. And the breakthrough is saying, look, just try to get variables that are linked to the business without manager intervention. Variables that are manager's actions, so the CEO, the CFO action, doesn't affect that variable too much, because if it affects too much, then the variable is not comparable. And cash profitability, that's why it's superior. And there is no doubt about that operating profitability. So now the question is, hey, what about investments? Because if investments is exactly the same as accruals, well, operating profitability plus investments will be the same as cash profitability. Yeah. Why don't we address the question, is investment the same as accruals? And that's a very simple answer. It's the same as water and oil. Nothing to do one with the other. Investments, and you don't even need historical data for that. You can look at today's data. You get the market. I'm going to get the market and create a matrix. And the matrix is going to be companies sorted by level of accruals on one axis, and the other axis, companies sorted by the level of investments. If they were exactly the same, I will have a diagonal. Only the diagonal, yeah? If one has nothing to do with the other, I will have a full grid, full of numbers, no diagonal. What do you have when you look at that matrix? A full grid. Accruals have absolutely nothing to do with investments. okay, so now we know that accruals have nothing to do with investments. So now the question is, okay, I can do operating profitability plus investments or cash profitability plus investments. Because you can use, since investments is not the same as accrual, you can apply to both of them. Yeah. And that's what we do. We use investments. We do use investments and we also use cash profitability. Why? Cash profitability is superior and investment is something that should be considered and we use that.
How does Avantis deal with sector weights in all of this?
That's a great question. And that's a topic for a long discussion. So there are two underlying things. First, let's say what we do, and then I tell you the other side of the coin. So we try to have well-diversified portfolios that have high expected returns. So in the market-wide strategies, sectors are not much of a big deal. The sector deviations are not so big. In the value strategies, there is big sector deviations. And the strategies may become very concentrated in particular sectors at some point in time. So what we do in the value strategies, we have sector caps. And so we don't want to have a portfolio that is completely dominated by one sector, because remember what we were speaking earlier. So there is a trade-off between risk and return. If you think about Marco, you don't want to finish with one security higher expected returns. And part of the diversification is having diversification across sectors. So we have sector caps, even though that may give up a little bit of expected returns. We have sector caps in order to ensure diversification in the value strategies. Now, the beauty of using the joint metric, so profitability and adjusted book to price, is that the concentrations that you get are not as big as if you use only, for example, book to price. If you only book to price, you finish with portfolios that are very, very heavy in financials. If you use profitability jointly adjusted book to price, you also have some biases, but they are less. Because some companies are priced more based on the cash flow, become more important than the book value. And so they don't become as concentrated as you want to think. But still, we have sector caps. So that's telling you what we do. Now, there is another thing that is good speaking. It's about why don't you use this valuation framework that you are using, that we are using, at the sector level? And then we put a portfolio of different sectors, so tilting within sector instead of tilting all across. And we don't do tilting within sector because it has a little bit lower expected returns than tilting all across. The volatility of the portfolios are very similar, but you're giving up returns. And why you're giving up returns? Imagine that the whole sector moves toward low discount rates. Yeah. If the whole sector moves towards low discount rate because the price goes up and up and up, then the whole sector suddenly is going to have low expected returns. And if you do tilting within sector, you're going to have the most attractive companies within that sector, but those are not as attractive as companies in other sectors. So you are giving up a little bit of expected returns. What do you get? What's the benefit of doing tilting within sector? You reduce tracking error. So if you want to have a strategy that is like enhanced indexing, probably tilting within sector makes sense. If you are not trying to do that, you're trying to add expected returns to create components. So someone, an advisor, can create a good asset allocation. What we do probably makes more sense.
Okay. I want to make sure I understand. So I'm going to try and reiterate what you said. You're tilting toward value across sectors, not within sectors, and applying a sector cap.
Yes, exactly.
What is the sector cap?
In the value strategy, we have an absolute sector cap of 30%. So we don't want sectors to grow 30% in the strategy that we have. Now, then there is a caveat. Let's suppose that someone hires us to manage a portfolio in some particular market where that market has 40% in financials. So we have to adjust the sector cap relative to that market. But in our current strategies, our sector cap is 30%.
Interesting. Okay. You also mentioned one of the downsides potentially being tracking error. What about industry-specific risk?
That's why we have the sector caps. So we want to have sector caps because we want to be diversified across all the sectors. Yeah.
Got it. You mentioned a few times or alluded to a few times adjusted book value. Can you talk about the adjustments that you make to book?
Yeah, yes, of course, of course. So when you're pricing a company, what you want is some measure of the equity of the company. And no one knows the equity of the company. So you have to come with a proxy. So the way to use a proxy, you can use book value. Now, if you look at book value has several components. One of them is goodwill, for example. And goodwill is certainly not equity. It's an accounting plug. And so we get rid of goodwill from our measure of book. We book X goodwill. That's why we say adjusted book value. So why this makes sense? So first, where does goodwill come from? So if I buy your company, my book value after the merger will have a line item called goodwill. And why is that? So when I'm buying your company, Ben, what I'm paying for? I'm paying for your equity. You have beautiful building, assets, liability. I'm paying your building, but I'm also paying for your cash flows. Yeah. My book value will go up for whatever I pay for your old company. So it's going to go up for whatever I pay for your cash flows and also will go up for whatever I pay for your equity, you know, assets minus liabilities. So how that's going to be reflected in my book after the merger? When it's going to be reflected, whatever I pay for your equity, you know, your building, whatnot, is going to be line items. It's going to be power, property, plant, and equipment. It's going to say, oh, I bought this building from Ben. This is the fair value of that building. Boom. My book value goes up in that line item for whatever I do. So where does what I pay, whatever I pay for your cash flows, where does it go in my book? But there is no line item in my book for cash flows in the future. So, but where do I put it? There is no place to put it. So whatever I pay for your cash flows goes in goodwill. If I pay a premium for your company, that's also going to be in goodwill. So everything I pay for your cash flows goes into goodwill. So goodwill is really not a reflection of the equity. It's a reflection of whatever I thought that your future cash flows will be worth. And that comes into my book. So it makes no sense. Even more, let's suppose that both of us decide to merge. And both of us have the same book to price, yeah? But your company is much bigger than mine, yeah? If we merge, and absolutely no synergies. Synergies are irrelevant here because you finish with goodwill without, even if there is absolutely no synergy. And I told you, you're paying for cash flows. It shows up in the book. It's no synergies. So let's suppose that your company and my company are going to merge, yeah? If we decide to merge, then the book of the final company will be different if I merge into you or if you merge into me. Even if we continue being independent businesses, just because it's going to be Cameron and Ben is the surviving name or Eduardo and company is a surviving name, the merged company, even though we will continue operating in isolation without doing any synergy or anything, the book value will be changing, and it will be changing depending if surviving name is Bain and Cameron or Eduardo and Company. If I do adjusted book to price, the adjusted book, the way I do it, book value will not change. So goodwill is something that's really an accounting plug. It's a reflection of cash flows on the company that's been acquired. And if there is a premium, it's also going to be reflecting because a premium is when you the discounted rate of those cash flows that you're buying is low. So that's why the price of the company goes up. So you have to adjust if you want to make a good variable. If you look at historical data, you see that there is a premium performance when you do this adjustment. Now, this adjustment was not too relevant if you go 20, 25 years ago because there was a change in accounting standards. And now if you look at the typical U.S. company, the goodwill represents around 45% of the book value of the average U.S. company. And international also has increased dramatically because of change in accounting standards. So if you go to the original research, for example, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years ago, thinking about book to price and whatnot, that book to price that you have in the past is more reflective of today's adjusted book than today's book because of the change of meaning of book, because of change in accounting standards. So it makes absolute sense to change. And it's even more. Think about, Ben, and now I put you on the spot. Let's suppose that your company is a company that has very, very high price to fundamentals. So your discount rate embedded in that price is very, very low. Yeah. So your companies are super high price. What will you do as a CEO of the company if you want to add value to your shareholders? Well, what you will do is get your shares and start buying other companies. And you are willing to pay premiums for all those other companies. Why? Because your shares are hard currency. Anything that you pay, you buy, any other company that you buy even if you pay a premium, we have a positive NPV because your embedded discount rate in your price is very, very low. Right. So you will go and buy companies with your shares. You are adding value to your shareholders by doing that. Yeah. What are you doing in that process? You are increasing and increasing and increasing your book. The more that you pay, the more that you increase your book. If you adjust goodwill, that's gone. If you don't adjust, you're going to have a company that has very low discount rate because they're increasing, increasing, increasing the goodwill portion of the book. We start looking as a company that has low price to book. And so you have to make those adjustments.
It's very compelling the way that you explain it. Earlier, you talked about the importance of testing theories like that empirically. What does the premium for the goodwill adjustment look like in the data?
30 something basis points a year, 36 basis points a year. We have it right up there on the website. Anyone that wants to see it, please call us. Sunil did amazing work on that. Sunil Wahal, Professor Sunil Wahal did amazing work on this. We've been engaged people that are in the accounting standards, and there is a whole discussion about goodwill because it has some benefits to have it there. It has some more benefits. If you remember, you go back in time, it was treated completely different. But today, whenever you buy a company and you create goodwill, that becomes sticky. It doesn't go away unless there is an impairment. So you say, I'm buying all these future cash flows of this company and the value of these future cash flows. That's not exactly how it works, but that's how I paraphrase it. The value of these future cash flows is going to be 100 million. Yeah. So you have 100 million in goodwill. And now that 100 million stays there unless someone says, well, that 100 million is not 100 million. Now we didn't get it right. It should be 50. So you're writing it down or you're just completely writing it off to zero. Yeah. Imagine you are the CEO or CFO of the company. Do you want to do that? No, because it affects your balance sheet and affects your earnings. You don't want to do that. So the auditors have to push you very hard and you're going to push against that. So that's why it's a huge number today in the book of companies. That's why you have to take into account. You have no choice.
Very interesting. Can we shift to fixed income for a bit?
Right.
So the existence of a credit premium, I think it's fair to say, is sometimes contested. Can you tell us what the Avantis view is on pursuing a credit premium in your fixed income?
Look, I don't contest it at all, to be fair. Do I think that the BBB company will have the same discount rate in their bonds as a treasury? No, I don't think. I think the BBB company will have a higher discount rate. And so that means a higher expected return. And that's what you see. You see a credit premium. So we have no issue with credit. I think a credit is part of the market. If I'm willing to, I have to have a reason why to deviate to the market. Why will I say I'm not going to buy credit? I only buy treasury. No. Credit is part of the market, happy to buy credit. We invest in credit, and there is no issue with that for us. As long as you do it right, you do it in a diversified way with low cost and whatnot, I think there is no issue, and we do believe in the credit thing.
Similar to what we asked about with equities earlier, what are the advantages of the Avantis fixed income strategies relative to just buying cap-weighted bonds?
Well, cap weighted is a very interesting thing because in equities, cap weighted is market cap weighted. You are weighting by the equity of the company you want to think. In bonds, you are weighting by the debt of the company. So I issue more debt, I have more weight. But when you say cap weighted, it's interesting. We said debt weighted bonds indices, not cap weighted bond indices, but that's what really is. But if you look at the typical index, what does an index does? The index is whenever there is a new issue, so a company issues a new bond, that bond gets added to the index and it's held in the index. For example, if you look at an index like the ARC, it's held to basically very close to maturity. So you are adding bonds automatically to your index and holding them disregarding what? Yeah. And so where is the risk return trade-off making that trade? There is no risk return trade-off of making the trade. You are automatically adding bonds. No matter if they're attractive from the expected returns or not. And you're holding them no matter what. And that really doesn't make any sense, in particular if you have a debt-weighted portfolio, like a debt-weighted index, because that's what they are. And so that's the approach that we do. So what we're trying to do is whenever we add bonds, and this is systematically done, it's not just bond picking. So whenever we add bonds to the portfolio, we add them because they can enhance our expected returns or it can enhance our diversification. We are not forced to hold them to maturity. At some point, we may sell that bond and buy another bond that happens to add more to expected returns to the diversification that they want that we hold. It's the same, you know, we're speaking about the small value. The small value, you buy a company, there's more value because it's attractive from the point of view of price and fundamentals. If the price goes up, suddenly it used to be attractive. Now it's not so attractive. You sell that and you buy another one. So the same process you can think when you're speaking about our fixed income. We buy bonds that happen to be attractive from the point of view of expected returns and hold them. At some point, they may be less attractive. And so we have to sell them and buy a new one. If you think about a bond, it has an average yield to maturity. That average yield to maturity gives you an idea of the average return that the bond has from the moment that you buy it today till maturity. Now, that doesn't mean that every year that bond will have that expected return. That's the average expected return over all these years. At different holding periods, you're going to have different expected returns. So what we do with these yield curves to assess what's expected return of the bonds today, of the bonds in the market and the bonds in our portfolio over for a holding period, let's say for a year. If what we hold is not attractive of what is in the market, we're willing to affect the trade if it makes sense from the cost point of view, the expected return after cost. And if we do that, we are really making decisions based on risk-return trade-off, not just automatically adding bonds and holding them without any regard for what that adds to an investor. And that's the difference.
I have a practical question for you, Eduardo. Client might ask, okay, my bond portfolio, let's say it's down this year 10%. I can now buy a term deposit for 5 years at 4 to 5%. Why would I not want to do that?
Well, you should have done it before, no? Now it's 10%. In reality, when you buy fixed income, you should consider all the alternatives. You should consider term deposits. You should consider certainly the fixed income, and you should consider even fixed index annuities. At the end of the day, if you can get annuities without the commission, it's also kind of a synthetic bond, if you want to think. You should consider all of that. And in some cases, one may make more sense than the other. If you buy a term deposit and you want to get a premium, you're going to get long-term deposits that brings liquidity, the same as the fixed index annuity, and that may be okay for some part of the portfolio. The bonds bring also liquidity, so you can sell them at any point when you need it. And so you have the expected returns, and you also have the liquidity. So it depends on what part of the portfolio you may use one more than the other or use all of them.
I want to come back to the sizing of premium tilt or factor tilts. We talked earlier about how should someone decide if factors make sense? Who does a 100% small cap value make sense for? When you design something like the all equity market strategy, which has tilts, how do you determine what those tilts should be in a product like that?
That's a great question, because at the end of the day, I'm trying to infer taste and preference and needs of people.
Right.
We just, you know, I don't know all the people, so I have to make assumptions. Right. So we have been working with advisors for a long, long time. And advisors are the ones really assessing the need, the tolerances and everything that investors have. No, I don't speak with any investor and try to assess. And when you're creating a strategy like an all equity strategy that we have, we are trying to satisfy some need. And so we pay attention to these portfolios that advisors are putting together. So we try to get a portfolio that has reasonable tilts that can be done in a commingled way. It can be, and it can be done very efficiently. And so the tilts that we have there is a reflection of what we see in the advisor's portfolios. Mm. No one has the same portfolio. I cannot imagine, and maybe someone does, by the way, but I cannot imagine that everyone has exactly the same portfolio. Now, what does it mean commingling? Commingling, so when you buy an ETF, you can say, well, that ETF is not exactly what I would want. I would want something that's a little bit different. Well, the solution, if you want something a little bit different, is you buy an SMA. And it's going to be a little bit different, but the costs are going to be higher, the efficiencies are going to be lower. So whenever we decide to commingle into a vehicle, we are just giving up a little bit of our personal decision for the benefits of commingling. The same as when you make a custom-made suit. Yeah, you can have a custom make suit that has 5 buttons instead of 4 buttons. Yeah, it's going to cost you more. It's not going to be as efficient. maybe that's important, so important for you. Or if not, they say, I'm okay with three buttons. I go there. And so basically what we try to do is create a commingled solution that makes a lot of sense, that is commonly seen advisor portfolio and can help advisors have a one-stop shop or minimize the number of components, because these kind of strategies are very efficient from the point of view of rebalancing. So advisors can use it for small accounts. Advisors can use them in mixing with fixed income or some other portfolio and minimize the number of components and increase efficiency.
Why have we not seen an emerging market small cap value strategy?
That's a good question. I think we have one, but that's in the eye of the beholder. So if you think we have a market-wide strategy, the emerging markets equity, and then we have an emerging markets value strategy, and that value strategy excludes mega cap companies. So if you think about mega caps value have lower premium than mid caps and small cap value. And so what we say is, instead of just focus, the emerging market is a smaller market, no? It's less liquid market than whatnot.
Yeah.
So I say, instead of just focusing only on the small caps, let's focus on the small and mid caps. And let's exclude mega caps, basically. And let's try to create a strategy that has strong premiums that you see in mid and small caps, but also have the liquidity and the diversification benefits. So we settle not for a small, we set it for a portfolio that excludes mega caps. So basically, it's kind of mid and small caps.
Interesting. Maybe it is a small cap value strategy or close.
It's not a small cap per se, because it has a little high. But if you look at the premiums by market capitalization, the premiums in mega caps are much smaller than the premiums in mid cap. And mid caps and small caps, and small caps are higher. I'm not telling you now, but when you go to emerging markets, the costs are higher and everything, the liquidity is lower. So you're making a trade-off. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. Something that I was surprised to see, just because it doesn't fit with the typical type of products that you guys make, was the inflation-focused equity strategy. What goes into developing something like that?
I love it. Because, yeah, I know. I knew that this was going to throw a little bit of questions to us. And I love those questions. And remember, I think, I don't know if it was you, Ben, or Cameron, at the very beginning, I said, well, there are hedging needs that people do. Not when we're speaking about people, why people deviate from the market. People deviate from taste and preference, or for rational decisions. And the rational decisions may be taxes or hedging needs and whatnot. And so this goes into the hedging needs. So we are not telling you that these securities have a higher premium by any means. We're telling you that these securities provide on top of the typical premiums that we deal with, you know, the valuation framework, we can also deliver something that is like a hedging need, some portfolio that for certain investor makes sense. So I'm going to divide your question in a couple of things. First, from the market point of view, and then from the investor point of view. From the market point of view, there are some securities that do better in some inflationary environment than others. No, there are some securities that we consider have positive correlation, we think, with long-term inflation, and others that have negative. And the market is the average of both set of securities. And so if you think about the market having some securities having positive correlation with long-term inflation, what kind of securities are those? Well, there are securities that really have pricing power in whatever they produce, and they are not affected by pricing power in whatever they need to provide their services or to create their outputs. And for example, think about oil. If you are an oil company, if oil goes up, inflation also goes up, commodity future strategy buying oil futures go up, and oil stocks probably go up. So you see a linkage there between long-term inflation and the cost, in this particular case, energy or oil. And so there is a set of securities that are more correlated with inflation than others. And so from that point of view, I can create a portfolio that restricts the universe of securities, these securities that have higher expected correlation with inflation. And then once I have that universe of securities that have higher correlation with inflation, and I can use all the toolkit that we spoke before about valuations, profitability, adjusted book to price, and whatnot. So from the point of view, can I create a strategy? Yes, I can. And I can do it in a diversified way. And it's more, I'm not limiting to using a commodity futures, that because commodity futures doesn't have high expected return. The premium is basically zero. I can do it in equities when you have the equity premium. And so, and I can do it in a structure that is very tax efficient. So everything is very appealing from the product point of view. I can create a portfolio that is expected to be correlated with inflation, that have higher expected returns, and it's very tax efficient. No, that's great. From the investor point of view, you say, okay, you can create that. So why should I care? Who the heck is going to buy that portfolio? That goes back to what we spoke before. Look, there are certain investors that are more sensitive to inflation than others. You know, some people have their compensation completely adjusted by inflation, so they are not really sensitive. Some others, just the opposite. So some investors are more sensitive to inflation than others. And having a tilt towards a strategy like this, it really enhances the portfolio. By no means, I'm telling you that will enhance the expected return, like buying a value strategy. Think about this like a way to tilt a core strategy for not expected return, but for hedging it. You should have similar expected returns than you have when you have a core strategy, but you add in a hedging benefit that you don't have if you have a regular strategy. So there is some investor that will have a benefit for that. It's certainly better than buying other instruments that you have out there that can provide you inflation hedging. Like if you buy TIPS, it's perfect inflation hedge, much better than us. But the opportunity cost of buying TIPS is huge. Effective returns is super low. Then you say, well, I can buy commodities strategy. My commodity strategy is basically have low returns. And on top of having low returns, it's very, very tax inefficient. So it's really not great. And so this gives you the high expected returns and the tax efficiencies and the low fees and everything. So it's good.
So we talked about like the value profitability premium. The research there is pretty good, and it goes back decades. How would you compare the rigor of the research behind something like the inflation-focused equity strategy to the more general value profitability premium?
Well, value profitability applies on top of the subset of security. We are by no means, we are not saying no. So basically, this is restricting the value and profitability on a subset of securities. So like you can apply value profitability on a small cap securities, or you can say apply a value and profitability on large cap securities. Here we're saying we're going to apply value and profitability on top of a set of securities that are expected to have higher correlation with long-term inflation. By no means we're saying that you should give up the value and profitability. No. You should use that, but on a subset of securities that are expected to have higher correlation with inflation. So it's very strong, all this.
So this question might be a little too inside baseball, and maybe you can't answer, but I'm curious if you have product examples or tweaks to methodology that were considered, but you ended up not implementing.
Yeah, more. Have you wasted time and money? The answer is yes. Have you wasted time and money? Yeah, we have wasted tons of time and money, but I don't consider that a waste. You know, whatever you learn, it's not a waste. And I give you an example. And this is in the spirit of everything that we have in speak. So we spoke about cash profitability. Yeah, there is another variable that people have considered profitability, that is free cash flows. I'm sure you guys have heard about this. Free cash flows. What is the relation between free cash flow and cash profitability? They are very, very similar. So if you get cash profitability and you subtract CapEx, capital expenses, you finish in free cash flows. So the difference between free cash flows and cash profitability is only one line item in the statement of cash flow called CapEx, the capital expenses. And we look at free cash flows and we were excited about free cash flow. Very excited to the point that we start thinking about implementation and the components of implementation while we were excited about that. And to be fair, we didn't do it because it doesn't work. And why it doesn't work? I'm going to give you a very simple example, and then I will link it to Robert Novi Marks. I think on Robert's paper, it was a great insight. So let's suppose that you have two companies and both companies, one company has great cash flows, so great cash profits, and the other one barely breaking even. Is zero cash profits. Yeah. And so you are running the company that's making a lot of money. So you decide to invest. Yeah. So you do capital expenses. So your free cash flow is going to be your cash profits minus your capex. And let's suppose that you're spending capex similar to cash flows. You finish with basically zero free cash flows. No, cash profitability minus capex Even though you're making a lot of money, you are investing in the business, you finish with zero free cash flows. On the other side, I'm running the company that makes no money. I'm not going to invest anything in CapEx. So you finish with basically zero free cash flows because your business is booming. I finish with zero cash flows because my business is making no money. And so you see, we added a variable that at best noise and really confuse the underlying businesses, how they are doing. We did all the analysis, we did all the regression, every simulation, and we find this is not working. And then we started scratching our head, why it's not working? And it's not working for the reason that we're telling you. It's not working because CapEx is a manager discretionary item in most cases. So a manager has a discretion how much to invest or not. And if you go back to the paper of Robert Pepper saying, go back to the variables that have as little management intervention as possible so you can have variables that are comparable. And CapEx is not that. CapEx has a lot of management intervention, so it's making things less comparable, and that didn't work. So despite all our excitement about free cash flows and everything, it just didn't work, and we didn't implement.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting to hear how that all happened.
We go beyond saying, oh, the numbers don't work. We try to understand why the numbers don't work from the conceptual point of view and linking to breakthroughs like Robert's breakthroughs. And that's important because you want to understand that creates knowledge that you can apply in other places.
On this topic of research, some competitor firms of Avantis, competitor firms that you may be very familiar with, have massive research teams, hundreds of PhD researchers. How does Avantis remain competitive on research?
I love it. So you really have to ask the question, what is all these research people doing at the end of the day? Because they may be doing marketing. They may be doing research. They may be doing client research. They can do different things at the end of the day. You don't know. If we look at all the breakthroughs in investments, and we were speaking about Robert, for example, a minute ago, I think that only one that I know came from a researcher working at the company, and this is more than 50 years ago. Most of that comes with people that are fully dedicated in this, in environments that are competitive, open forum of communication and challenging. And academia is probably one of the best places for that, if not the best place. You can have the biggest brains ever. You have them in isolation, not really want to work very well. You need the challenging environment. Look, I'm very involved with Caltech, and I love when I go there because you see the thriving, you know, fighting for ideas in a good way, you know, trying to advance the science and all that happened in academia. So anything that we're looking, we're speaking about profitability with all the different metrics of profitability, all that came from academia at the end of the day. So you can have a humongous research staff. And the question is, are you really, really adding value to your clients in the creation strategy, or you are increasing expenses? That's a fair question at the end of the day. Some people have big, big research teams because they're trying to find signals. I know people that work in shops that they are trying to find signals, and every quarter or every year they see, is the signal working or not? I don't believe in that. Probably you guys don't believe in that, but you know, you need researchers to do things like that. You know, we think about this differently. So look, let's use everyone's ideas. I don't care if it's mine. I don't care who's coming. If you have a good idea, we should consider. We should be open-minded. We should not have a t-shirt with our team. We are the Avantis team, and whatever is not Avantis is not good. No, Avantis is about whoever is out there that has a good idea, we're interested. Right. Because that's how you add value to your clients. But it has to make sense. It has to be something that we think that will persist in the future. But, we are open-minded. We're open-minded. I don't care where it comes from. Some of the concepts of accruals come from people that were on the other side of rational, were on the behavioral side. And so what's the problem with that? I don't have any problem with that. I want to hear everyone. And if we hear everyone, hopefully we can bring the best for our clients.
And to follow up on Ben's question, are there any disadvantages to being inside American Century as opposed to being an independent company?
Look, I love being inside American Century. I'm an employee of American Century with a different business card that says Avantis. And why we have a different business card? Because we happen to manage money differently. And that's why we start working in here. You know, American Century wanted to have something different, and here we are. So from that point of view, what do we do? So we manage money. So anything related to investment of Advantage products, we do it. And we have some marketing capabilities. So we create the content supporting our, and we have some client service capabilities. But we work with client services team inside American Century, data management, technology, all the different groups in American Century. We have some relations with them, and they have been terrific partners. Jonathan Thomas is great. You know, I have nothing to do. It's a pleasure working with him and all the management committee. They are great. Victor Sand, the CIO of American Century. I know him for something like 22 years or something like that. And that's why we are here. So American Century has been terrific. The people really care. They have been terrific partners for us. And what I love from American Century is how they are structured. So it's a private company. You know, all of us have great ideas why a private company is better than a public company. You don't have to think about quarterly earnings and proxy votings and whatnot. But, you know, every private company has a problem. At some point, the company will be sold. And if the company will be sold, ownership changes, everything can change. You cannot say management will not change. Everything will change when something happens. And so American Century solved that because James Star Wars Jr., that was the founder of American Century, donated all his shares to create the Star Wars Institute of Medical Research. So the controlling shareholder of American Century is an institute for medical research. They do cancer and genetic disease research. So it's private, but it's structured in perpetuity. And on top of that, the profits go to support a very good cost. And so it's great. I'm really proud to work in here.
The structure is very cool of American Century. Within the people who work at American Century for Aventis, in the Aventis group, what are most of those employees doing? Like, what kind of jobs do people have? Because the operations are presumably within American Century. What does Aventis do?
So Aventis, we don't have technology people working with that. We don't have a capital market team. We don't have a HR team. We don't have an accounting team. Right. We don't have a, think about all these amazing functions that you need to function. We don't have them because they exist already and they're really good. They have been running since 1958. And so why you are going to recreate the wheel is that wheel is working and it's well oiled and works amazingly well. So we're not doing anything of that. We are using those and they're providing great service to us and our clients. So it's great. So what do? We do investments because we manage money different than the guys at American Century. Whenever you do investment, you need to create all the collateral, the marketing supporting that investment. And we do that. We do all the collateral, all the content for the collateral, we create it ourselves. We don't have graphic designers, for example. We don't have people printing or creating websites. Those are people in South American Century that use our content and they find ways to deploy it. And that's the same way that they deploy material for the rest of American Century. So we have some client service in the RA channel and in the wealth management channel. For example, institutional channel, consultant relations channel. We work with American Century. And so we have a really, really good relationship and they're great people. It's just a pleasure working with them. I was yesterday in Dana Point and it was a big conference and whatnot. And I was together with a couple of guys, Gary and Rob from American Century, and speaking with a lot of advisors. And, you know, it's a pleasure working with them. I learn a lot from them and hopefully they learn something from us and hopefully all together can provide a better service to the clients.
It's a very clean setup. I do like it.
I'm telling you, these guys are really embracing innovation. They're not only because of working with that, they have done other things like Income America. That is a very innovative product that they associated with insurance companies in trying to solve the retirement problem. Amazing things. They are really, really trying to make the best for the clients and trying to find ways, not only inside what they have been doing forever, but associating with others or bringing others like us in order to try to bring benefits to the end clients.
Do you guys ever chat about investment philosophy? Because it's, like you mentioned, very different.
It's different. But I was speaking once with one of the portfolio managers for American Century, Jeff John, great guy, by the way. He does an active small value strategy. And if you hear him speak, it's quite amazing how similar, with implementations are different, the concept, but the concepts, no? I don't want to paraphrase, but I think he says, I want to buy companies that have a high quality and attractive pricing. And if you link that to profitability, what we do adjusted book market, the concepts are similar. Certainly implementation will be different, and I cannot have a comment because I really don't know enough. But it's interesting. You work all your life with your vision, just tunnel vision and what you're doing, but sometimes it's good to open your eyes and listen to others because you see commonality in many things and not commonality in other things. So you see, Eduardo, what are you guys really doing? And what I'm telling you, we're trying to systematize active management. And we're trying to do that by having all the benefits that you have with an index fund, that is transparency, low turnover, low fees, high tax efficiency, but with the benefits that trying not to have a dumb implementation like an index, trying to have an implementation that adds value, that considers valuations, that is. So we're trying to bring something that is different, and you know, different people try to do that in different ways. And our ways is through trying to systematize active management.
There are other firms who do that type of implementation, systematic active management, out there. Some direct competitors, and then some other firms that do similar systematic sort of factor tilted products. What do you consider to be the main competitive advantage of Avantis over competitors?
Well, everyone does something that I would say we think we're the best. If I don't think we're the best, we'll change to be the best. You know, and our job is to try to deliver the best. So, but I have to disclose that up front. But at the end of the day, things are not exactly the same. Even though at 10,000 feet, everyone is the same. You lower at 5,000, you can distinguish some people from another. You lower it, and you can distinguish more. And you know, when you look close enough, there is quite a lot of differences. So if you look at, for example, active share, it's a measure of how different the portfolios are. No, it's a simple measure of how different the portfolios are. You look at the active share, for example, our small value relative to other small values, and you say, well, they are very similar, the same. Even to portfolios that you're saying they are very similar and you guys coming from the same place and everything, active share is like 60%. It's a big number. And why? Because things are different when you get to the granularity. And so we are different. And they are different because different belief or historical reasons or different implementations. So why not? Different managers will have different reasons why they are different, and we have a reason why we're different. And we're different because we think that we're doing the right thing.
If somebody wanted to compete with you, what's the most difficult part of what you do to replicate?
On the simplistic way, first, everyone is welcome to compete with us. And we know that there is no issue with that. Everyone is competing with us, even without replicating everything that we do. Everyone is competing with us. And we embrace that competition. And that's what keeps us certain that we have to do better and better and better every day. If you don't do better and better, then it's a problem, because let's suppose that we're doing the best, and that's what I told you. People will catch up. So you have to move the pole, you know, and do better and better. And you have to embrace every new technology. And we have shown that we embrace new technologies. Now, we came to market with what is called in the United States fully transparent active ETFs, and others follow. We came with extremely low fees, and people are still trying to catch up. We embrace fixed index annuities, for example, with no commissions for advisors. Why? Because we were speaking at the beginning, alternatives to fixed income. You know, we believe in fixed income, but also we know alternatives, and we embrace that. So we are always trying to think in the portfolio. We told you about wasting time with CapEx. Now that we can go forever from that. So we are always embracing how to do the next good thing for the clients. And that's what keeps you a little bit ahead of everyone else. Can someone come in and try to compete? I'm sure right. Everyone is trying to come in and compete. Even if we say, no, they shouldn't, they will do it either way. So
that's right.
Recognize that and try to run faster.
If you can say, what is the next big thing that you guys are working on?
We're always trying to work in solving clients' portfolios and trying to provide more tools and tools from the point of view investment solution. We are not a tool provider, by the way. We are not a technology company. We don't want to hear anything from us in tools or practice management. Now, we focus our things on having low fees and great investment solutions. And the content supporting that. And so we are always thinking about what to do. You saw the inflation focus equity strategy. That was something new. We had that in line to launch last year, to be fair. We didn't have the time because we were launching four other strategies. We launched a micro cap strategy. Like we call it a small cap, but it's really a micro cap strategy. Yeah. It's on the pricing point of view, 25 basis points. It's really super attractive. And then we launched responsible strategies. So this was in line, but we couldn't do it. So we just launched it. But the inflation equities, we were excited because it's not, some people will use it for tactical plays. Let me be clear. Some people will use it for tactical plays. But we think that it plays a strategic role in some investor portfolios. So when people think about asset allocation, for some investors, this really deserves a consideration. And that was exciting to us. We can really make someone's portfolio a little bit better off. We get excited about these things. And so I cannot tell you what's the next until we file and do it, but we're always thinking.
Long term, what's the succession plan for Avantis?
Well, that's a good question. From the point of view of ownership, American Century sold that because, you know, the structure that American Century has, I think it is amazing. And if you ever go to Kansas City, please let me know because I really, really want you to visit the Towers Institute if we have the opportunity because the research that they do there is unbelievable. And being able to be associated with American Century and Star Wars is amazing. So the ownership structure, that's not an issue. From the people's point of view, that's a good question. You say, I get that question. What happens if you die? Well, I always say, I hope my wife and my kids cry, but not too much because I want them to keep on going. All of us believe that we are unique and we are unique. But there is a lot of people that are unique and can add value to the chain that can replace and do better than us. So we have an amazing investment team. We have associations with great professors like Sunil. You know, Sunil is amazing. I don't know if you ever spoke with Sunil Wahal. Mm-hmm. He has a great paper about the cost of mutual funds that you may want to look at that or market microstructure. And a lot of things. And so we have a lot of people associated with us that will jump in and help. And we're always looking for people. We're always speaking with people. You know, even South American Center, there is some great people that interact with us. So I would not worry about that too much. And the ownership is the most important because at the end of the day, you change owners, God knows what's going to happen. The people certainly is at risk and the whole strategy of the company is at risk. So this has been solved and I'm really proud. When I decided to work here, I told my wife about all these associations with the Star Wars Institute and everything and some issues with cancer in my wife's family and whatnot. And she was very supportive, very happy with that. So I'm proud of that.
I already said this earlier, but the whole setup of American Century really is impressive. They've done a great job.
Yeah, we are having an event in next week there. And hopefully there's a bunch of investors going there. Again, maybe we do it again and maybe you guys can, but it's really impressive.
So we're Canadian. Many of our listeners are European. What would it take for Avantis to launch UCITS or Canadian products?
So everyone knows my phone number. If not, find it. Ask Cameron and Ben and call me or send an email. You can find me. It's not going to be too difficult for us to cross the pond, neither the Atlantic pond or the Pacific pond. It's not going to take long. Just give us a call. You can think I'm smiling, so that's telling you something. So just give us a call.
Very interesting. All right. So second to last question here, Eduardo, you referenced this earlier, your dissertation on the fatigue behavior of ductile FCC metals. You've got a PhD in aeronautics and you won an award for that dissertation. Can you talk more about the commonalities between aeronautics and asset management?
Well, aeronautics is a very long field. A plane flies because of a lot of things. So I don't think that I know all this because I know something, but not others. So when you're doing a PhD, you're working in some narrow fields and you're trying to advance the frontier of that narrow field. And what a PhD program teaches you is try to look at the problem, abstract it, try to create some model and try to solve that model to see that model that you created really reflects reality. So that's basically what we have been speaking all the time up to now, our evaluations. You know, they think about the evaluation framework. You see that empirical data fits the historical data. So you feel comfortable that the models that you're using work and that fits reality as well as possible. And so that's basically what I did. If you want to be more technical in what I did. And there was a physics problem. And there were a couple of physics. The FCC is one of them. But there were a couple of things. And you look at the physical problem. You try to see what drives that physical problem, what variables, in what concept, in what sense they interact. You try to create a model. And in my case, try to solve that model. Then, in my case, through computers. And then try to see if what you find to that, it really fits what you observed in reality. And then you feel comfortable your model is describing that and then can advance and create better materials or better processes and whatnot. It sounds similar. You have some optimization things in a very nonlinear optimization in some of the work that I did. And you think about nonlinear optimization. You are dealing with nonlinear optimization all the day in your life when you're harvesting losses, where you decide when to realize a capital gain, to invest in the new strategy of higher expected return. You have all this multidimensional set of variables that provide more or less optimal depending how you put them together. And it's very similar to what you think about investment, but it's very similar to how you think about running a company, or very similar to how you think about running marketing or everything. Because, you know, you always try to observe what's going on, try to create some idea in your mind of what's going on. That's a model. And then try to see if your model is fitting and try to improve things based on that model. And so it's all very similar in some sense or another.
Having been in the world of physics and the world of financial economics, how do you feel about hypothesis testing in physics, like what you were doing in your dissertation, versus in financial economics, where maybe there's more, I don't know, parameter uncertainty and things like that?
Yeah, in physics, you have a lot of parameter uncertainty.
Interesting.
Look, you have the new telescope, the James Webb telescope, yeah?
Yep.
And that telescope is finding things that we have an hypothesis based on what we were watching with through Hubble. And this new observation saying, hey, whatever we were thinking about based on Hubble is probably not extremely right. And we don't know yet, because James Webb has to be still calibrated to higher degree and whatnot. But it's out there and it's already just causing a lot of innovation, a lot of thinking. So there is always parameter uncertainty. There is always uncertainty. Look, reality is super complex. It's way more complex than the models that we put. So we have to try to enhance the model, make it robust, make it more complete. So if it's the same. So I think that all these problems are complicated.
Very interesting. And sets up our final question super well. Eduardo, how do you define success in your life?
That's a difficult one. I do the simple thing. So for me, I have an amazing wife. I have terrific sons, three sons. I have great parents and extended family, and that's part of success. You know, that's the foundation of your life. Without that, it doesn't matter if you make money or you are in newspaper like a superhero, but without that, it's a big hole in your life. And I'm so proud of all of them and how supportive they have been. And I hope to be able to provide support to them. It's amazing. And then I also have a great job with great teammates. And if you come here, we go for sushi across the street, like I mentioned, that place. You will see teammates that I have are second to none. Being associated with American Center and the Stowers Institute is really something that makes me proud. I donate money on my own to them because, look, trying to find cure for cancer, genetic diseases, that's something that affects all of us. And it's something that really makes me proud. It made me happy. Being associated with Caltech makes me happy because advancements in science, you know, even if it's not aeronautics, it's astronomy or whatever other field, it's just amazing. It's so cool to know more and make life better for everyone. And I feel that. And then if you go more to finance, another thing that I love is I've been very lucky to be able to meet so many people like you guys. I know you guys for a long time across countries and have so many great memories and friendships. I remember being once in Toronto. And there was an advisor who was Canadian, but like Scottish ancestry, and was doing the Highlander toss. And I can tell you my meetings in the Middle East, all across the United States, all across Canada, in Asia, in Australia, New Zealand. Meeting all these people has been terrific. Like you say, do I like to travel? I like to travel. I like to visit different people. I like to see different experience and interact with people. And the job has been allowed me to do that with people who are like friends, clients, consultants, advisors all across the world, wealth managers all around the world. And that has been a blessing. And I'm very happy about all that. So I've been lucky, I have to say. I've been very lucky.
Awesome. Well, Eduardo, great to see you again. And thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Just want to add a quick addendum to the episode. There was a question that we had intended to ask, and then we had told Eduardo that we were going to ask, but we skipped because it didn't go with the flow of the conversation. And we felt like we had already, it was one of the later questions. We felt like we had already had a great discussion, and it just didn't fit in the conversation. It is the decision that we made, which happens sometimes, no big deal. Eduardo noticed, which was impressive on its own. He noticed that we didn't ask this question. Clearly he had wanted to answer it. So he followed up by email afterwards saying, "Hey, I noticed that you didn't ask this question. Here's what I think about it." So the question was, how important is security lending revenue to the expected returns of Avantis funds? So I'm just going to read what he said because I think it's great information, and it's too bad we didn't ask her in the episode. So Eduardo said, securities lending is something that you should do to get extra benefits from the assets you own. And we do it, we being Avantis do it. In most cases, the investment manager is not the one doing the lending. The most common structure for US funds and ETFs, with few exceptions, is that the securities lending program is managed by the custodian for the benefit of the fund or ETFs. So the manager cannot claim skill in the process. Some people might consider having higher lending revenue a plus, but looking at lending revenue in isolation is just not right. You need to look at the whole package, the security return, or expected return, I guess, that's my commentary, plus the lending revenue. There is plenty of research that shows that securities that have high lending revenue tend to have low expected returns. That's why people short them. So securities lending is a way to increase those low expected returns. Still, a good security selection process that produces less exposure to securities with low expected returns seems to be better than maximizing securities lending revenue by holding low expected return securities. Remember, people pay to borrow those names with the expectation that even after costs, they will make money. So that's it. I just thought it was worth adding to the conversation because it's relevant to Avantis funds, and it's just great commentary in general.